All right, let's do some check-ins, some emotional check-ins. I am feeling distracted, a little fragmented. There's this intensity, urgency. Maybe a sort of confidence that I don't really like. Okay, so at upcoming events at the Stoa, we have a Memento Mori meditation, or inquiry, I should say, and that is with Jared Janes of the Both End podcast, and that is going to be at 11 a.m. Eastern time on Sunday. That's April 5th, so check that out. And then the same day, we have a Communitas invitation with Andrew Taggart. So that's April 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And you just go to the website, thestoa.ca, to RSVP there. And you can sign up for the mailing list for regular updates. Today's session at the Stoa is with Jordan Hall. He did a situational assessment, and it was quite intense. I talked to had a one-on-one with Jordan yesterday, and sort of got a download on where he's at. I think it's a good time to buckle up and then really see how we can be deployed with discernment. So that being said, let's jump in and find out what the situation is. Welcome to the Stoa. The Stoa is a digital campfire where we cohere and dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of what's happening now.
So I guess I'll just kind of dive in. I hope that we're not catching things at too much velocity because we're certainly moving pretty quickly. First order, I think, is to just kind of have an awareness of the notion of how to be able to hold multiple different scenarios in your head. So I'll be using language that has a bit of a Bayesian construct, which is to say that there's a whole bunch of possibilities of what's actually going on right now. And it's not quite clear exactly. And what I mean by that is both, it's not quite clear exactly what information is accurate. It's not quite clear exactly how to understand of the information that you have, what it implies in terms of what the state of the larger system is now and what it likely will look like in the future. So everything has to be held in a probability construct. What's the probability of certain events? Pardon me. I've been doing a lot more talking than my voice box is used to. So the highest confidence model that I'm operating with right now is one where this is about a 40% confidence. So I don't have anything above 50%, but the highest confidence model that I'm operating right now is that we're right now in the middle of a multi-systemic cascade of failure. So what that means is if you imagine you've got a bucket full of water and you're carrying it, and if you walk at a certain speed, the sloshing of the water doesn't come over the top, but then you trip. And so you lurch forward a little bit, and so the sloshing comes out. And that's a systemic feedback loop where the environment you're walking through leads to a perturbation effect that's larger than the containment environment of this particular subdomain, which happens to be the water in the bucket, moves the water out of the bucket, and you have a spillover. Okay, now imagine if instead of being water in the bucket, it happens to be oil in the bucket. And so when it spilled, it didn't spill just water, it spilled oil all over your feet and the ground you're walking on. So now your next step increases, your next step is slipperier. And so the likelihood of you spilling oil goes up. So now you have a systemic feedback loop where cascade effects actually feed back and forth between different system dynamics. So let me give you a more concrete example of where we are right now. Trivially, we have the example of this, the perturbation effect of the virus had a characteristic of uncertainty multiplied by velocity that led to a really big impact. So by uncertainty, what I mean is, and this I think is legitimately true, although there are certainly some intentionality questions we need to answer, but as the information around what was going on in China began to show up, there really was a, what the heck is this going, what's happening? What is the the epidemiology, what's the impact, what's the reality of it. And because we have the notion of asymptomatic carriers, we have a situation where even as early as beginning of March, the reality of the degree of the number of people who are infected and it's R naught was just a big question mark. But as we've discovered, the velocity of that is actually quite high. I think right now I heard from the WHO that they're modeling globally a 2.5-day doubling rate, which is actually higher than most models had seen. But that's, of course, global. So we're looking at places where reporting is not, the data that we're getting on reporting is not very good because we know testing is really, really poor. So they're trying to actually get a sense of what is it, call it really, working backwards from the data that we have. So that uncertainty plus velocity ended up hitting our systems in like a lot of different places and hitting them kind of hard. So it's that bucket sloshing. Well, one of the places where it sloshed over was a feedback loop between unstable or fragile political choice-making systems and a combination of bureaucracies that have been sitting in a level of complacency for a long time. So they just weren't ready, willing, or able to move out of complacency into choice-making. Political situations where the amount of fighting between political groups in fighting was very, very high. So they weren't willing to step back and put their knives away to actually look at the problem over there. And technocratic operating models where the way of making sense of the environment was locked into particular ways of thinking that weren't able to slow down, look around and say, oh shit, our ways of thinking are the things that need to change. So as a consequence, what ended up happening was is that the whole system, instead of actually shifting to a way of responding to the new environment, actually started to lurch in a very dysfunctional, coordinated way, which is to say, we ended up, like say the UK, they lurched into a direction of defaulting to political divisiveness originally. So let's focus on the people inside, whatever it's called, the prime minister's office. The original default was, don't believe the panic data, focus on protecting the economy, that kind of a thinking. And then, by the way, a counter reaction inside the political structure, which activated a whole bunch of different constructs that said, oh, no, lurch back in the other direction. But now we actually have to do a big shelter in place. And the reason why I'm bringing up that kind of choice-making tissue is that's the communications layer between one domain and another domain. So what happened was is that we had a big impact. But instead of the effect of that impact actually being mitigated and not increasing, our choice-making structures actually increased the impact of that on the financial system and the economy. So then we suddenly had everybody going into shelter in place, which then turned off the flow of the economy, which created a big perturbation at the level of finance and economy. Right? So we've got these cascade effects. Now what's happening is as I'm watching it, we're seeing more and more cascade effects percolating through all system dynamics. So a thing to track, for example, is the spreading of the locust plague entering into Africa. And so we now have a gigantic out-of-control locust plague, which would have been a big problem under any circumstances. But now it's happening in an environment where the governments are having a very hard time dealing with just the implications of virus multiplied by economy. You've got huge populations of people who are being forced to shelter in place while their crops are being devoured by a plague of locusts. When they come out of shelter in place, there's not going to be enough food, right? So that's think about what that implies in terms of other implications around violence and political structures. Similarly, right now we've got a situation where in say the United States, you got the mental health crisis, which I called had already hit code red from my model 2 weeks ago, and it's now actually beginning to percolate out. So we're beginning to see increases in suicide rates in vulnerable populations, which by the way is both elderly and teenagers. And as the fact of that begins to be broadcast, as the consciousness of that shows up, we know historically that ends up having a feedback loop. We don't have infrastructure for actually being able to deal with people who are pulled out of all context. Like literally people are pulled out of all of their support structures into completely novel environments with massive, big, scary uncertainty hitting them and isolated. Right? So we actually have no infrastructure for being able to deal with that. And so that's going to have a feedback loop in one direction. Another direction it's going to have is that some people, when they're faced with that kind of a mental duress, don't go in the direction of depression or suicide. They go into the direction of exploding into antisocial behavior. So another metric that's starting to show up is crime. So crime rates are beginning to build. And crime rates are beginning to build both in terms of N, number. So number of crimes happening, particularly in urban environments, are going up, but also in intensity. So property crimes are beginning to move into like just breaking into shops and stealing things. Not quite rampant looting, but the story on the ground is that that's going up. And violent crimes are also beginning to go up. Like, for example, a big one to track if you're looking at data is something called home invasions. So people actually just going straight into homes and holding everybody at gunpoint and doing whatever it is they choose to do at that moment, which varies across the violent crime metric. Now, if you notice the implications of that, that has cascade effects in terms of people's willingness to sit back and hope that the existing political structure, i.e. police forces and local governance, will take care of them. At a certain point, they stop believing in that. That means they move into an environment of trying to figure out what they're going to do. It's unlikely that the choices being made by people on the ground in an uncoordinated fashion, driven largely by fear of personal safety, are going to be very, very good. So that at the situational assessment at the high level is my highest confidence model, which again is only about a 40%, is that in somewhere between 4 and 12 weeks, which is actually a pretty large window given how much time, how fast things are changing, we'll be moving into a situation of very high liminality. And what I mean by that, if you guys remember, I think in some other location, sorry, I can't say that. I don't know if it happened in this group. So the metaphor of thinking about system dynamics that I was using at some point was the notion of like a heavy ball rolling in a groove on like a glass table. And the groove has a deep, holds the ball. So the balls can just follow the groove. But as the groove gets shallower, the possibility of the ball popping out of the groove or shifting out and then coming back in just goes up. And at a certain point, if the groove is completely flat, the future state of the ball now is completely undecidable. Any energy will cause it to move. There's nothing that holds it in place. And so when I say a point of high liminality, what I mean is that the table becomes very flat. And you can think of that about that at almost a, your personal, at an individual level. What that means is something like your psychological inertia, the degree to which the choices that you make in the future are determined by the context that you've been in the past, drops to zero. Right? That would be the maximum level of flatness, so that your future choice is undetermined by identity structures, by psychological models, by commitments that you've made in the past, and just kind of opens up to anything could happen. Now, I doubt we'll reach that point because in the abstract, that's an extremely high degree of liminality. But call it even 15% or 30% inertial has an enormous number of future states. And it's kind of like, you know, if you imagine all the planets orbiting the sun, so you know how a gravity well works and that holds the planets in order. Imagine if suddenly the sun just disappeared. Where do the planets go? Right, that's kind of what my model says we're going to be looking at in 4 to 12 weeks. So the question is, where does it go? And that that the inquiry into that question, I think, is the most relevant, though by no means the most salient inquiry for anybody who's trying to actually respond to the real depth of the crisis that we find ourselves in. By my lights, there's effectively three kinds of directions that it goes from there, two of which are bad. Broad brush. One is vectoring in the direction of atomization, balkanization, and increasingly escalating conflict at smaller scales. So this is where individuals and groups begin to lose faith in the larger scale constructs that they're part of and begin to take care of themselves at the expense of anything that isn't on the inside of their group. And by the way, we're seeing this in the EU right now. Right? So as a case study, watch the EU. Serbia exited the EU in everything but name. Hungary just exited the EU in everything but name. And they're making choices now that are oriented towards in-group versus out-group. And by the way, it's not always clear exactly what the in-group is. In Hungary's case, maybe it's Hungary, maybe it's, you know, the leadership. It's not quite clear. The opposite direction of that vector is the authoritarian direction. Right? So to the degree to which existing governance structures, instead of breaking up, solidify and increase their capacity to impose top-down order on the subcomponents inside of them, that's the opposite. And of course, these are mutually reinforcing, meaning that as the energy of balkanization increases, the pressure on top-down structures to fight back with more authoritarian control increases. And basically, these two forces co-evolve until one or the other takes over. Right? So if the balkanization forces win in a certain domain, the top-down system just breaks apart, and then it becomes obligate that everybody, all the energy has to move here because you can no longer rely on top-down structures, and vice versa. So both of those are natural forks in this kind of environment. And by the way, just do a survey on all on history everywhere, and you'll see that that tends to be how the system operates. The third way is something that goes up. The third way is some capacity to utilize the possibility space that has been latent in our environment for the past probably 20 or 30 years, which is to say things we could have done but have not actually been done because existing structures are in the way, and to embody them, to make them, to realize them, to actualize them relatively rapidly, like we're talking 4 to 12 weeks, in a fashion that creates a way for that energy, those planets that just got freed from the gravitational attractor of the sun, to re-enter into a new coherent orbit, but one that is neither balkanization nor authoritarian. Wow. I apologize. That may have made not the least bit of sense. I may have just thrown a whole bunch of big balls into the pool. But I mean, you get what you pay for, which is you didn't pay anything. So
I kind of wanted you to keep on going. So let's turn it to Q&A then. If you have a question for Jordan, write in the chat box. If you want me to read on your behalf, let me know. I'm curious how you are personally sense-making in this environment, Jordan. Like you come to that number 40%. How did you come to that number? And how do you see other entities sense-making in this environment, like the Blue Church or whatnot?
Ah, great. So the first answer has to do with, I'm going to actually just kind of run full speed here. So I'm going to be saying things that it may be difficult to track because I'm using a whole lot of metaphors to describe things that are not easy to describe. So sense-making in the contemporary environment involves taking any, in the past you may have seen me refer to something as quote unquote my sense-maker. And what I mean by that is a graph, a set of relationships. That graph is composed of two kinds of things. One is the edge or the bond on that graph. And the second is the epistemological perspective that is connected through that node. Right? So we'll use Daniel Schmachtenberger as an example. Daniel is attached to my sense maker. That bond is strong. I know Daniel very well. I trust his perspective. I trust his good faith. I have a deep understanding of his methodologies and where he will have blind spots and where he'll have strong input. Right? So you can think of that as a nice big thick pipe made out of carbon fiber. A lot of stuff can flow through that. And I know that he, if I double click on him, he has a really big graph. Right? So there's a lot of capacity on the other side of that node. That capacity in terms of both relationality, he's connected to a lot of surface area in perspective that can perceive a lot of stuff. And he has a very rich and mature epistemology, which allows him to make sense of his environment effectively. Right. So I've got a sense maker, Daniel, connected to me, which is my sense maker. That's it. Right. Iterate. Relationships combined with sense-making capacities that have high degrees of discernment. You know what you're dealing with, so you can actually convert that into higher quality sense and recursion, right? So it's not a one-way trip. I'm connected to Daniel. Daniel's connected to me, right? I provide input to him from the totality of my sense-maker modulated through me. He has a way of understanding what that means in terms of the bias of what's likely to be coming through me that's upright, that's good sense, and what's bad sense. He puts that into his sense making. He percolates that back out through his relationality into the set of relationships that he's connected to, and you get a feedback back and forth, but it flows back and forth the whole system. In fact, if you map the entire graph, you have a series of ripples that are going out and going in at different levels, at different time sequences. And this creates a gigantic set of interference patterns that pops into a single unified field of a metacoherence of signal. Does that make sense? That's what it looks like. That's the answer to the question. Now, what happens is that everybody cannot help but be connected to that network in some fashion. You're going to have a local piece of it. Your local piece of the relationships you're working with, your discernment on those relationships, and the capacity to move energy through it. But I guarantee you that I'm connected to all of you by no larger than 4 ends. At this point right now, 1 end, because I kind of know all of you, but certainly with 3 or 4 ends in terms of actual relationships that have real energy flowing through them. So the challenge is to figure out how to actually upgrade the fabric of that sense-making graph. find the relationship that you're working with that have the highest, strongest bonds, strengthen them in terms of both the quality of trust and, which is to say, intimacy and vulnerability of honesty and integrity flowing across that bond, and the discernment. Real serious, hey, I noticed that in the past you've said things that had high confidence but sometimes weren't actually true. I need to call you on that and ask harder questions so that the next time something comes through, you're doing a better job at your end. And by the way, do the same thing for me, because we actually got to mutually get better at knowing what we know as opposed to drawing inferences based upon potentially epistemologically weak models. First person experience is the highest octane fuel. So in many cases, my current sense maker has been upgraded by probably a factor of 50 over the past 8 weeks, because a whole bunch of people are just being willing to make risks and jump out of context where they weren't willing to share information, where they are willing to share information. And a lot of it is first person or second person. So they're direct hands-on with things that are actually happening, so you can get much higher octane conversations. The other one is that graphs are coming together, focusing on centers of gravity. So let's say, for example, let's just go like a very prosaic technology, like detection. What are the underlying technologies for detecting the presence of virus? Well, ordinarily, we actually do, frankly, a terrible job at that because it's a very complex question. But what's happening now is there's actually a center of gravity on that. What I mean is it's a place where there's a domain. What's the answer to the notion of detection? There's a collection of people who know what the fuck they're talking about, who are now gathering together, and they're increasingly effectively sharing their information in a fashion that has one agenda, which is to get to the truth. Now, by the way, that ain't the whole story. There's lots of folks who have multiple agendas that are creating noise in the environment. But there's a fusion cell, a gathering together of different capacities and different perspectives that are unifying in a way of making sense of this environment. And as that becomes more sensible, and if you connect to that node, you're now actually getting very high quality reality on what's the possibility in that domain, which then you can propagate out to other environments. So that evolution of fusion cells in the larger environment, which gives higher quality reality modeling, is another big piece of the story for me. But the short answer is I'm increasing the quality of my trust. I'm adding a whole lot of new people and chunks to the network. And a lot of people are doing this and dropping previous agendas and just focusing on what is real.
All right. My next question, Noam, was actually...
I apologize. Do you want me to talk about the Blue Church here or not?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Blue Church right now is in the process of having two things happen simultaneously. And this is how it always happens. So the Blue Church has a chronos structure, which is to say a formal hierarchy based upon bureaucratic commitments. That is weak bonds. Right? It has a lot of inertia that under ordinary circumstances, people talk to the guy who they're supposed to talk to using the formal structures they're supposed to use. But they're weak because nobody actually gives a fuck, right? At the end of the day, you don't really care. You only care because it's the thing you do that doesn't get you fired or get you out. You know, it's kind of like covalent bonds instead of ionic bonds. But it's got a lot of inertia. So what's happening right now is the Blue Church is beginning to notice, which is to say the individual human beings who actually make that up, that the structures that they are operating in can't respond to the circumstance that's happening. So vertical one and vertical two clearly are getting blindsided. They're getting blindsided constantly. And they notice they can't actually have the conversation they need to have across. So what's happening is people in those environments are just dropping the formality and just jumping out and connecting. And that's creating a mesh network inside the Blue Church, transverse to existing hierarchies, transverse to existing processes by individuals who are basically saying, fuck it, I'm going to actually try to figure out how to do the right thing and beginning to form a cross hash. I should say, by the way, that's how it always happens. Like if you actually look at these kinds of dynamics in any structure, you've got formal vertical structures that jump into crisis. What always happens is the individual nodes pop out of the formal structure, look around for anybody else who's actually showing up as effective and begin to reweave into some kind of a mesh, which then actually supports the formal structure. Because now you've actually got information that's flowing that's relevant and the formal structure can actually be directed towards more effective choices. So both of those moves are happening simultaneously in the Blue Church.
Okay, so Noam, can you unmute yourself and ask Jordan your question?
Sure. So speaking, you've already spoken a little bit more to the third option and somewhat started to answer what turned out to be my question. So in the next, given the 4 to 12 week timeline, What challenges, what kinds of challenges do you see that will be the ones that they'll cohere for people who are already kind of working within this, the paradigm of this third option? Like one thing I've noticed was the Masks for All and how that kind of developed over the last month and it changed what was sort of the top-down approach. I'm wondering if that gives us any hints and generally what you've been seeing and what kind of things to expect.
Okay. The way it looks to me is a little bit like something like a compression wave at the edge of salience that generates a lot of energy. And so for Masks for All, masks, the fact that there was a need for and an absence of masks was a simple thing. It landed. People were like, oh, I get that. And my energy of desiring to help or act could land on something that was a real problem and a simple problem in the sense that you could make sense of it. It wasn't hard to understand what the fuck a mask was and why it was important. So everybody tried to figure out how to address it using their local knowledge and capacity. So you got this huge spinning up of energy. And that huge spinning up of energy was like a compression wave. It kind of popped people where they were. You started seeing a creation of new bonds. People getting up and saying, hey, how do I help? And they grabbed their friends. They found connections that they didn't know they had in their network. They began to kind of search, looking up, figuring out, changing operating methodologies. All right. Now, in many cases, that actually added a lot of chaos to the situation. You know, you kind of started getting, you know, people pulling masks out of environments that would have been better handled by a different path, or pinging each other so rapidly that people got overwhelmed with sort of requests for help or opportunities to help, et cetera, right? So in many cases, it actually created a lot of chaos in the environment. But two good things came out of it. One good thing was it actually did, in some sense, let's call it almost instantaneously, over a period of like 2 weeks, an enormous amount of capacity from an unprecedented number of different modalities showed up that began to actually solve the problem. Like, so it's almost like capillary action. We had one big artery plugged into the tissue and suddenly 10,000 capillaries just went shoop and every cell got connected. And from my perspective right now, the masked problem is more or less a solved problem, which is to say we aren't there yet, but the momentum is now moving downhill. And in 10 days or so, most mask problems will actually be solved. Okay, that's one good thing. Two, more fundamentally, was the invariant of that action. So what the fuck did we just do? What happened just then? What did it look like for us to suddenly jump up out of our inertial frames into how do we actually figure things out in this entirely new modality? That also upgraded, like a consciousness-raising event of, oh, wait, hold on. If I behave in this way, and here's the things that didn't work, and here's the things that did work. Oh, wait, shit, here comes another compression wave with a different name, you know? You know, the next compression wave was called ventilators, but the next compression wave is called something else, right? As the systemic crisis, as the sort of the scary story I just unfurled rolls out, new events emerge that continue to put pressure on where we are and create energy to drive people to put their own, to take risks and to challenge themselves to develop, to grow into this new possibility. And that's the thing, right? It's like we're surfing the wave. We're trying to find where's the pocket of the energy of that wave and just stick with it as hard as possible, recognizing that the situation is actually changing. So by the time you've actually done the concrete thing, so there's many people right now who actually, like say, makers who tried to spin up ways of printing face shields. A lot of those efforts just were a waste of time. It turns out that they couldn't figure it out, and or by the time they came to a solution, a better solution had already been created. And that's okay, because the underlying metastructure of how they went about responding now becomes core infrastructure for them and everyone else of how you respond to these kinds of crises in general. So it's the next set of solutions. I tell you what, right now, I'm telling you, in 2 months, we're going to have to fucking figure out how to feed 1 billion people. We don't have a clue how to do that. So getting ahead of the curve and thinking, okay, how do we take the learnings we just learned and how to produce a bunch of masks? How do we apply that globally to figuring out how to get food into places that right now we don't even have high quality connections with across socio-technological dynamics, where maybe we even have political inhibitions about how we're going to go about doing it. Existing NGOs are going to have some degree of efficacy, but they're not going to be able to solve the problem. So that's an example of something which is an event that is coming, that if we can start looking at how we're solving problems now, as the events happen now, it's like that wave is passing through our social environment. Every time it passes through, it leaves behind it, for those who are paying the closest attention, more structure of the new form. And that's that meeting of the new challenges with new possibilities actualized as the wave of energy actually passes through is the key element. That's the key, the biggest possibility and challenge.
All right, Nicholas, you had a question?
Yeah, hi, Jordan. So you were talking about the first vector atomization and then the second one, you know, more governance. And then the third way, which is the one we all hope for. But then you talked about sense making and getting to truth through relationship, right? And we're not the only people doing that, right? They're doing that there as well in these two vectors. So once they get a better sense of the truth, couldn't they abuse it to go into, you know, their directions? And is there a way of, I guess, it's not inevitable that we're going to go our third way, right? So how...
Sorry. I'm sorry if I gave that the impression. I would say that's a really lucky chance if it pulls out that way. It's exactly the opposite of that. Yeah, it's definitely not inevitable. I would say right now the likelihood of that is about 0.1%.
Exactly. So I guess my question is, okay, what can we do now to really get that going, right? I mean, it's like an emergency almost. So I guess I wanted more concrete advice. I was just on a call with Jim talking about this, right? And then my mind goes all, okay, what is the practicality in all this? Like, what can we actionably do? Because, yeah, that's my question.
Yeah. So is that a shared question? You can nod or put thumbs up, because it's a hard question. So let's see. So what I was just talking about, I was trying to describe the answer to your question. So if you kind of rewind back a little bit and listen to what I said, mm-hmm. that's the answer. So it's something like, so think about trying to imagine like one of those video games where there's a bunch like Mario, where you're jumping through a landscape. Now transition this to the notion of like n-dimensional parkour through mystery space. We don't know how to solve the problem. What we do know is that every once in a while, some platform pops up, some structure pops up that has an energy against it, where you can actually pop, you can leap to it, and then you can figure out how to leap to the next piece. So the actualization of the solution to the problem of how do we actually solve N95 masks has nothing to do with N95 masks, right? It's actually an abstract, concrete example of how we actually solve mystery problems in new modality space. So, okay, look at it, get in it, drive into it directly so you get an embodied experience of what the reality looks like. It's okay, reckless abandon, just jump into it. But recognize that's not the thing you're doing. What you're actually doing is learning how that general pace operates, right? What's the thing that shows up? Things that show up are, how do you support a higher quality of sense making? What do connections look like? What does choice making look like in this kind of a context? I'm saying that in general, right? In all cases, that kind of thing is going to show up. Next wave that comes through, dive the fuck into it, but now dive into it with more structure, not just you, but maybe a we. What does your local node start to have capacity to actually respond? Can you have better sense making of the larger context, of the bigger story? Where is your local node actually relevant? What kind of unique capacities do you have that you're holding the piece that you personally, you as a group, can actually hold? And how do you begin to egolessly partition the story of that environment so that people are more and more effectively holding the piece they want to hold? One of the real challenges that people who feel the third weight is a good idea have is, generally speaking, they've been holding way too much. Right? Everybody who's kind of a change maker has been dealing more or less with no allies and no support. So they have like one piece of the story that they actually are supposed to be dealing with, but they've been dealing with 80% of the story because they kind of have to, right? My one little widget doesn't fucking work if somebody else isn't building the whole car. So I'm out there trying to build a whole car in a really shitty way, right? And you've got a tire connected to a really crappy transmission. Well, our challenge right now is to say, okay, you're the tire guy, I'm the transmission guy, where's the steering wheel guy? Let's find these people and each of us drop all the stuff that you're working on that ain't yours and figure out how to get better and better and better at actually fine-tuning the piece that you're supposed to be holding and then finding the people who are holding the other pieces until that comes into a coherent, organized whole that suddenly, bam, instantaneously, out of magic almost, we actually have a car. I should tell you, by the way, that's going to be exponential. It will look really weird and confusing and ineffective as it's beginning to go up. So leaping through case studies, leaping through things that are practical on the ground and trying to solve concrete actual problems that are material, like N95s and ventilators and helping old people and helping teenagers and, you know, whatever food, whatever it happens to be, like real concrete problems on the ground, is great because it keeps your morale up and it keeps your razor sharp. You can't engage in this sort of collective masturbatory circle jerk of trying to pretend like you're going to change the world by waving your hands real hard and talking big talk. You're focused on the hardcore thing that's real. And if it doesn't work, it didn't work. Teaches you how to actually do that. While in the meantime, the meta problem of learning how to do that collectively begins to become embodied. More and more people get clarity on, oh shit, I used to be carrying 15 balls. I got to drop 9 of those right now. I can't even, the number of inbound inquiries that are coming to me through those 15, I can't even handle them. So hopefully you guys, here's somebody who's going to be better for that. Just route them away from me. Route them to somebody who's better and get really good at who's better. And then, okay, here's the 3 that I'm holding, right? And then now I take responsibility for making sure that everything that comes in there is high quality. We can't have any more half-assed, can't have any more like people who are, and I'm going to be very sort of mean-spirited. There's a class of people up here at the top who are the folks who are perceive the subtle, okay? The sensitive individuals. They've been talking about this stuff for a long time. They are not the people right now who are dispositionally or cognitively empowered to deal with problems at this level. It just, that's not their job, right? They're the mystics and the artists who've been absorbing this stuff for a long time. We need to interface with them and pull out the deepest, most concrete nuggets of absolute wisdom. They're like compressed diamond at the middle of the ball of coal. Pull that out and now begin to move that into levels of actualization. So this is an honoring of those who came before us, who brought the words of wisdom, but also recognition. The challenge now is to actually, in the act of honoring, the honoring is a crucible that melts away that which is in fact not real in the story and pulls out the actual most compressed piece of fundamental wisdom and must-haves and pull that into this constellation that's trying to assemble itself.
Ariel, you have a question for Jordan? I'll unmute you.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one you're referring to because there's two Ariel going. I'm actually Katie, but there was one. Huh?
It's you.
Okay. So one thing that's been kind of interesting to me to observe over the past few weeks, or at least I feel like I'm perceiving something, is one tendency of people's response to this coronavirus crisis and the economic crisis that's related to it. It seems like reactions and responses tend to be both. There's a trend towards falling along ideological lines and like making divisions more divided, since taking any kind of action like quarantining or not quarantining, going with government recommendations or not going with government recommendations, are now concrete things rather than just kind of like abstract things that you're talking about, like where you fall on the political spectrum. So I'm seeing that play out. But then on the other hand, I'm seeing more people actually unite with those in their communities who might not be politically or tribally, or I think the term that you use is blue church, red church aligned. I was wondering if you see those two things happening, like more stratification but also more unification, and how you see them interacting with one another, if you're picking up on those
dynamics. Oh absolutely. So let me see, I'll work backwards from the right hand side of that. So the natural state of humans is in fact to bring those different dispositions and perspectives into wholes. That's our strongest location, right? Tribes, natural, like really old-fashioned Stone Age tribes, intrinsically must have all of those dispositions and therefore all of those perspectives as part of the tribe. That's how we were selected for. That's why those dispositions exist differentially in human populations. So the integration of groups of fragmented perspectives and dispositions into new wholes is almost like what happens when we get rid of the artificial constraints. We naturally begin to recohere in that fashion because that's our more natural state. And by the way, it's the way that we're actually able to achieve consciousness as a group, because that gives us the net, like we are obligate tribal. We just have to get that. As individuals, we aren't real beings. Like our reality as humans is in groups that are coherent. That's where we actually begin to feel the most fully real, because it's actually the reality of it. And a lot of junk starts to drop away when you actually begin to drop back into real relationship and right relationship with other people. God, it makes it so easy. I was talking to somebody yesterday about some of the proposals that I'm putting out there. And one of the things she said is, this feels very scary to me as an introvert. I said, well, that makes sense. But that's because in your mind, you're thinking of it as you as an introvert. But what should happen is you should find yourself in this context having extroverts who have relationality with you, inviting you into this. You don't have to become an extrovert to play this game. Extroverts will play the extrovert game and they will invite the introverts in to play the introvert piece. And suddenly everybody's holding the piece that they're supposed to hold at that level, right? So you've got, you know, 50 different dimensions of individuals' tendencies, of psychological and by experiential tendencies, and the integration of that. So that's the right-hand side. Now let's look at the left-hand side, because I think it's actually ended up being really interestingly confusing as to why the in-group, out-group boundaries behave the way that they did as this thing moves through cultural and psychological space. And it's actually because this event is orthogonal to the constructs that we've developed. So I'll give a very concrete example, because I watched it very closely with regard to Red Insurgency. So more or less, Team Red, in the US, I don't know about this elsewhere, is a result of a long artificial polarization at the physical level, like literally people moving physically apart, and at the virtual level, conversations become more and more filter bubbles. Team Blue as well, by the way. I'll just talk about Team Red because I watched them closely. Sorting along dispositional lines, right? So to use the flag of just ordinary psychology, like people who have a personality trait oriented more in the direction of, say, conscientiousness tend to radically disproportionately align themselves with an increasingly polarized conservative mindset. Well, this particular event, okay, so that's one. Two is they then formed in-group, out-group tribalisms that began to define things that were out-group to them. Well, in this particular event, we had this weird thing where a story of invader, like disgusting external invader, violating our integrity of our borders, a virus, sickness, illness coming in, which pegs the chart, right, for Team Red's underlying fundamental disposition at a typological level. Like that's as high on the threat vector as you can possibly get, right? Was being signaled by the mainstream media, who they've already identified as being obligate outgroup. That fucker is a hard psychological thing to integrate, right? If I listen to these guys, everything I've been psychologically preparing myself for the past 20 years is every signal coming out of these guys must be false. And this signal is the highest gain signal for me to actually believe is true. I'm in the middle of a paradox, right? So the only way out of that paradox is either to drop all of this or to invent a delusionary narrative right here that allows me to maintain my pre-existing condition. I think that happened across a lot of different psychological domains. I think it's actually driving a lot of the reasons why we're seeing stuff happen. So what ends up happening is that's like a giant plow tearing through the soil of our pre-existing psychological and dispositional and political commitments. And as the reality of the event hits, you're seeing two movements. One movement is an increasing like delusional hysteria, increasingly manic, and a slaughtering and breaking down of that fabric and a recoherence of people into wherever they land, which, if it's even vaguely healthy, looks like new wholenesses, right? Because that's real. That's like a real natural place. So if you get the artificiality breaking apart, and what's just super powerful and astounding in this event is the degree to which people have been forced out of their comfortable context. So you just popped into an absolutely bizarre circumstance where you're not going to work, for good or for bad, right? Maybe you're happy not going to work because you got enough savings to actually call it a weird ass vacation. And maybe it's real bad. You don't have any savings and things get scary. But if you're sitting with your parents and your kids and you're online all the time and everything's going around as mysterious. So it's like a really crazy, like you can't, it's hard to fit your existing delusional narrative into this environment. So it makes that delusional narrative, the sheer forces that are powerful. And so that's that bi-directional movement.
Thanks. Yeah, that makes sense.
The other Ariel, did you want to piggyback on that?
Sure. Yeah, so basically my question was like, I guess sort of related to this idea of like why wholeness is more real than fragmentation. Like I was like listening to your third scenario, it seems pretty appealing. Could like reconvene into some kind of good configuration in 4 to 12 weeks that unlocks all this latent potential. But I'm wondering whether maybe like the existing systems we have are so like calcified that the potential latent potential is so deeply locked in that maybe a longer period of like destruction or creative destruction is necessary. Like basically could path one eventually lead to path three?
So when I say wholeness is more real, I don't necessarily mean it's more, has more power in the contemporary environment. I mean that it's more, it has a deeper basis and therefore is more invariant under different conditions. So that all things being equal, it's where things would go. But as you say, all things ain't equal. So now the question is, it's almost like I've got a river and the river's got a current and it's going in one direction. If that's the only thing going on, my little, cooler of beer is going to go in that direction. But at the same time, I've got a guy with a motorboat who's got a rope tied around my cooler and he's pulling it the opposite direction. There we go. That's a pretty good model for the reality that we're in. So what I would say is that in point of fact, the feedback loop between one and two, that tension and the increasing intensity of that tension is actually what I'm describing as giving rise to the space for path three. That's what's going on right now. The conversation I was just having with Ariel One was that, right? You've got a breaking up of the motorboat's capacity because shit's just like weirder than it thought. Or is she Ariel? Oh, sorry, you're not even Ariel, but in my universe, you are now. But there's a point. Right, there's a lacune. There's a point at which you throw the ball into the air, and as it's going up, it slows down. Then it hits a singular point at the very top where suddenly it's sort of no force and no velocity, and then it comes back down. Right? That's where you want to catch it. That's where the possibility space of shifting things in a different location are at its maximum, but where other gravitational forces haven't already started pulling it. I don't know if you've ever seen like those trapeze artists where they swing really hard and they swing back and forth and they let go and then they grab the person at the top. Well, I don't know if you know and understand the physics of that, but there's a very specific point where they can grab, where the strength of the human arm can actually hold. If you grab them too early, their velocity is too high and they're going to pop right out. If you grab them too late, gravity's now accelerated them and they're going to pop right out. There's a spot right up in the middle where the air, everything's kind of up in the air, and the ability for hands to grab each other and hold and bind is strong enough to actually hold the whole thing together. That's the window you're targeting, right? So what I'm seeing is it's going to look like this. Existing inertia is going to break down. It's going to break down. These differential forces are going to break it apart. A window will open. In that window, the possibility of the third attractor is at its maximum. If the third attractor does not cohere with enough integrity and enough velocity, then other forces will begin to have more pull, and attractor one and two will have the highest likelihood. Probability would begin to move more and more away from three and towards one and two. Aho.
So this might be the last question. Charles, can you unmute yourself and ask Jordan your question?
Hey, Jordan, thanks for the time. People in this world understand your analysis, but when I try to communicate this to other people who aren't in this world, it sounds like I'm speaking completely different language. How do you bridge that communication gap?
Well, you know what? I tell you what, you can imagine my circumstance. Hold on one second. I'm just copying and pasting some so I don't lose it. All right. So I've actually been practicing this for a long time. And you should ought to see the kind of crazy ass words that used to come out of Daniel's mouth before he worked on this thing. principles, values, why, what, how, in that order. If you speak to whys and get whys really landing, you've got most of the problem solved. If people are oriented around the meaningfulness of something, then you work in the direction of values, principles and values. And this is about what. Now, if you're speaking to somebody who's a former Vietnam veteran, you need to kind of work from their interiority. What are the what's that resonate with them deeply? What are the values that have been the driving force of their being in the world since the day they were born? And communicate this in the language that connects with that. Become their own sense-making vehicle. Right? You're not trying to explain your, you don't want to try even vaguely to cause their epistemology to look like your epistemology, because that there's a waste of time. What you want to do is to figure out how to actually get out of the fine-grained structure of epistemology and get to the coarse-grained structure of values and principles. Say, are we aligned on these? Can we agree that corruption is rampant and bad? Yep. Okay, good. We're on the same page now. Now the only question is exactly how do we begin to deal with it? And if I jump too fast to the end state, my solution to that is either going to be dealing with stuff they don't care about because I'm focusing on things that aren't their world, or my solution is not going to make any sense. It's going to cause people to pull back. So let's take it step by step. What are areas? So if I'm talking to a Vietnam vet, I'm going to talk about that poor Navy admiral who got fired for doing the right thing. I don't know if you know about that story, but that enraged a whole bunch of people because it's the way they make sense of the world. You can use examples of what's going on in the real world. I posted something from a doctor a couple of days ago. K-Dog, I think, is the way he talks about himself. It's a medical doctor, right? And he is livid. He was livid because the reality that he knows is the case, which is that his medical system is run by a bunch of fuckheads who have no idea about how medicine ought to be operated to control things out of situations of complete incongruity, are actually now for real putting doctors at risk. A doctor was fired for complaining that there was inadequate PPD in their hospital. Right, so he was fired, a doctor, right now, in the middle of a crisis, was fired for saying that that hospital needed more PPE. Now, was it Zeta, Z-Dog, K-Dog? Z-Dog MD was pissed. And what he said was this. He said, look, my tribe, which is the tribe of healers, we are going to be focused on solving this crisis. Right? We're going to put ourselves in harm's way and we're going to try to help people. But when this thing is over, we are going to burn this motherfucker down. Right? And if you just listen to the language he uses and the things he focuses on and abstract out the detail, because I'm not a doctor. I don't come from his world. I don't know exactly what his concerns are. But when I listen to the things he's talking about, I can transpose to the things I understand and say, yep, I know exactly what you're talking about. Great. Everybody has the same point of view. Now, what I would say at a very high level is the primary shape of the problem we're dealing with is three things. One, we've got a system that orients people towards making bad choices. All right. So we have to deal with that at a systemic level. How do we liberate people to make choices? How do we put people in a corner where they have to actually make choices for the first time in quite a while? The virus is helping us on that front, and there's more things we can put in place to do it. Two, the classic distinction, right? More or less, we're struggling with the fact that there's a small number of malevolent men and a very large number of weak men. All right, fair enough. We need to put weak men to a context where they actually have to be forced to use their weakness to make choices that are good choices. And we're going to have to find out exactly where these malevolent men are, and we've got to get them out of the equation. So something along the lines of a message coming through from the top and from the bottom that justice will be returned and that we're coming no matter what happens. That's a big part of this third attractor. And there's a strength and an energy to it. You got to get the weak men realizing that the right choice right now is to stop making passive choices that are hurting everybody and to either let go and let other people take over or begin to actually recover their courage and do the right thing. And you got to put on notice that the malevolent men, the days of malevolence are over. All right, we're all going to figure out how to solve this problem right now. Come hell or high water, we're going to figure it out together. But when it's done, we're going to burn this motherfucker to the ground and we're going to restore justice on a global basis. And it can be done, by the way. The third attractor, by no question, could do that. So it's just a matter of setting that our teeth to the bit and making sure we make that happen.
I feel the intensity flowing through my body right now. So we'll end here. I'll make some closing announcements in a moment. Jordan, do you have any closing thoughts?
No, I'm all worked up too. So I think we'll probably leave it there.
Cool. Yeah. And I don't know where the Stoa project is going, but I feel like tremendously motivated to experiment with different forms of relationality quickly and, you know, hopefully emancipate the daemon. So we'll see where this goes. So for next session, Daniel, you're here. We're having a metagame mastermind session at 6:30 Eastern time. Do you want to unmute yourself and just tell us what that's about?
Sure. Can everybody hear me? Yeah. So tonight's session, if it's successful, actually might be quite complementary to a lot of what Jordan talked about today. We're going to explore how the formation of digital gangs can help people maintain their sovereignty and respond to the meta crisis. And this is really for people who are looking to connect with others and participate. So I really encourage you to join tonight.
Thanks, Daniel. And you can RSVP on the website, thestoa.ca. Check out the mailing list for daily updates. And I'm viewing the Stoa as a gift for all of us to freely use in this time of need. If you're inspired to give a gift to the Stoa, just go to the website and check out the gift economy for more information. All right. Thank you, Jordan. And thanks, everyone, for the excellent questions today.